Okay, we're walking through the Sermon on the Mount as a part of our Sunday morning class right now, and we have covered most of chapter 5. We'll finish up chapter 5 today, but just trying to remind us where we are in the context of Matthew chapter 5. I know some of you have not been here and have not been a part of the class, but Jesus is in Galilee, goes up on a mountain in Galilee. We don't know what mountain. Been a lot of people that have conjectured as to what mountain he was on. We don't know. That's the answer. But he goes up on a mountain. He has the multitudes following him. And on this occasion preaches at least for our recordings, a rather lengthy sermon. Some have thought that maybe what we're reading in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is just Matthew pulling from a lot of different sermons and compiling it together. That's not the way this is written. It's not the way that we come across this. This was a lesson in which Jesus was trying to get a lot of information out to the people. But as you'll see in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus sometimes preaches the same thing more than once. And wouldn't you expect that to be needed? We don't always get stuff the first time we hear it. Do you expect these folks got it the first time they heard it? There were some lessons, some principles that they needed to hear over and over. And so don't be alarmed when you get over to Luke chapter 6. And Luke chapter 6 looks a whole lot like Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, but it doesn't have everything. Well, that's okay. It's not the same sermon. He's preaching some of the same things, but on a different occasion. And so here's Jesus as we've tried to go through this lesson and to develop kind of the outline that we're following. Jesus is focusing in on the inward character of his followers. And so when you read through the Beatitudes, that's what he's focused on, is the inward character of who is a child of God, who is a follower of Christ. And it's not just something on the external. That's where the Pharisees placed the emphasis, was on the external, the outward appearance. And so Jesus says, hang on, let's take a step backwards. Let's look on the inside. At the kind of character that a child of God needs to have, recognizing that he's going to look different on the outside than everybody else, but truly he's going to look different on the inside than everybody else. He's going to be a happy person. That's what the word blessed means. He's going to be a happy person, not based upon how circumstances are going. That's not how he determines his happiness. It's not based upon how people treat him that day. That's not how he determines his happiness. He sets out to say, I'm a child of God, and I'm going to be happy. I'm going to consider myself blessed when I humble myself before God, when I look at sin and I mourn over it, when I recognize that I need to be meek and self-controlled and I need to hunger and thirst for righteousness, that I need to be somebody who's a peacemaker, somebody who's pure of heart, and somebody who looks at persecution and says, you know what? I'm not worried about that. If I'm being persecuted for the name of Jesus, that's a good thing because I must be doing something right. And so he focuses in on the inward person, says, all right, now you're the salt of the earth, you're the light of the world. He says that kind of inward person has an influence on people around him. It's not just you and God, and that's how sometimes we live our lives. Well, you know, this is just, my life's just between me and God, and nobody else matters. Well, yes, it's between me and God, but I have a responsibility to have a positive influence, a godly influence, on those people who are around me, and to be that preserving agent like salt is, to be that flavoring agent like salt is, to be that guiding light for people around me. So you see these principles, then you get down to chapter 5 and verse 20. And we've talked about chapter 5 and verse 20 being one of the key verses in this sermon, because a lot of what we're looking at, especially in the rest of chapter 5, is based upon chapter 5 and verse 20, where all of these people who'd put their influence on the outward appearance of things, Jesus says, your righteousness needs to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. These are people that are concerned about their outward appearance. These are people that are more concerned about their traditions than they are the law of God. These are people that have rejected certain elements of the law of God because they didn't fit their preconceived ideas. And he says, no, your righteousness has to exceed theirs. And so he spends the rest of that chapter, this chapter we're looking at in chapter 5, focusing in on the heart in recognition that the heart of a child of God is a lot different. And so he's going to draw six contrasts. We looked at three of those contrasts last week, and we'll look at the other three contrasts that he's drawing at the end of the chapter this week. And the contrasts are not just between the old law and the new law. That's sometimes I think we've looked at these six things and we thought, well, Jesus is doing away with the old law and he's bringing in the new covenant, the new law. That's not what he's doing. He's not doing away with God saying thou shalt not commit adultery. He's not doing away with God saying thou shalt not murder. He's not doing away with that so he can bring in the new law. He's dealing with what the scribes and the Pharisees had done to God's law, and how they had, well, here's what they say about God's law, but here's the traditions and their own ideas that they've built around them. So that's what he's contrasting. That's what he's trying to help the followers to see is, okay, I need to focus on God's law, truly what God's law was meant to be, but to recognize that here's a man who's saying, but I say to you, he's not just quoting the scribes, he's not just quoting from even the law of Moses or the prophets, he's not just quoting from them, he's speaking as one who has authority. And that's his focus as he goes through this. So we looked last week in chapter 5 and verse 21, the contrast that Jesus draws between what they were teaching about murder and anger and hatred, and what he tells his followers that you can't, verse 22, you can't be angry with your brother and still be right with God. You've got to guard your heart in that regard. Verse 27, we saw that Jesus talked about you shall not commit adultery. Again, he's not doing away with that law. He's going back and building upon it to say that it's not only sinful to commit adultery, but it's sinful to look at a woman in order to lust for her in one's heart. And so both of those are equally sinful in the eyes of God. So it's not just controlling our actions, it's controlling our thoughts and our heart. And then verse 31, he dealt with the matter of divorce and their idea. And what did we have last week? About 2 or 3 minutes to spend on these verses? You need about 2 or 3 months on them. But in verse 31, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. The Jews thought that was a command. They thought those first four verses of Deuteronomy chapter 24, they thought that was a command of God. And so, well, I'm tired of being married, so all I've got to do is get a certificate of divorce, give it to her, and we're done. That wasn't God's idea at all. That wasn't God's ideal at all. God hates divorce, Malachi 2 and verse 16 teaches. That was not part of God's original plan. You read through the book of Genesis. How many times do you read about divorce in the book of Genesis? You don't read about it. Well, why not? Because God's original plan for marriage was for a man to leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and for the two to become one flesh. That's God's original plan. And it was not in God's will that divorce come about. But when it did come about, wouldn't it be right of God to regulate what's happening with divorce? Can you imagine God saying, I want you to stay together and not be divorced, and then not give any regulations once man started this practice of divorce? And so that's what Deuteronomy 24 is God trying to regulate. Okay, well, if you're going to do this, then here's how you do it properly. And so remember what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19 about what they were doing. He says, Moses permitted this because of the hardness of your hearts. Not because God wanted it, and not even because God commanded it, but because of the hardness of your hearts. And so verse 32, Jesus says, but I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except, and I don't know what your Bible has, maybe it has the word sexual immorality, maybe you've got the word fornication. I like the word fornication better. Probably sexual immorality maybe is a little more understandable in some respects than the word fornication. I mean, how often do you use the word fornication on a daily basis? I mean, in everyday conversation, right? I mean, you're all over Facebook and it's got the word fornication everywhere. I mean, we don't use the word. Now, we don't talk about sexual immorality all that much either. But there's a very specific definition for those terms. Sexual immorality is not merely looking after a woman to lust after her. Sexual immorality is not merely flirting with somebody. Sexual immorality is fornication, and fornication is sexual intercourse that is not between a husband and his wife. And so it is a very specific term where God has placed sex inside of the bounds of marriage, and when that is engaged in outside of the bounds of marriage, that is the one exception that God gives to a man to divorce his wife and to marry someone else. That concept back up in verse 28 about looking after a woman to lust for her, that's not fornication. The definition of fornication is sexual intercourse, unlawful sexual intercourse, that's outside of the husband-wife relationship. So any sexual intercourse that takes place that's not between a husband and the woman he is married to, not the woman he intends to marry, not the woman that he plans to marry, the woman who he is at that time married to, that's fornication. Lusting for somebody is not intercourse. And so in verse 28, where Jesus is dealing with that, that is not an exception. It's not a right to divorce your spouse because they have lusted for another woman. It's not a right to divorce your spouse because you have found your spouse is struggling with pornography. Jesus is not giving that as an exception to his rule about divorce and remarriage. He is just walking it back to a matter of the heart to say, you've got to guard your heart and make sure your heart is not causing you to sin against someone else. Helen, you got your hand up? Okay. Right. Has committed adultery with her, and then the next three words, in his heart. How do you commit adultery? How do you commit fornication in your heart? How do you commit intercourse? The definition of the word is sexual intercourse outside of the bounds of marriage. How do you commit intercourse in your heart? Intercourse is a very intimate physical activity. And so that is a very definite sin that is committed with the body. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 will talk about how obviously that involves two individuals. And so the difference is those three words that Jesus is using at the end of that he's committed adultery with her in his heart. Where is this sin taking place? This is a sin that is taking place in the heart. What is adultery? Adultery, fornication, is a sin that takes place with the body when intercourse is engaged in. And so there is a difference there. And that's one of the differences that Jesus is drawing here. Is there a difference between murder, physical activity that somebody engages in, and murder in the heart? Is there a difference in that? Can you be tried and convicted? Not yet, hopefully. Can you be tried and convicted of wanting to kill somebody in your heart? Not yet, right? We're not to Minority Report days yet, right? We can't be convicted of our thoughts before we have them. Does Jesus draw a difference between the murder, the action, and murder in the heart? There's a difference. But are they both sin? Yes. Can they have different consequences? Well, certainly they can have different consequences and on a human level, but on a spiritual level, we've got to make sure we're guarding ourselves against not only go back to verse 20. That's what Jesus is saying, is your righteousness is not just a matter of what you do on the outside. Your righteousness has to be concerned about where your heart is on the inside. So those are the first three contrasts that Jesus draws. So get to verse 33. And verse 33, Jesus deals with a fourth contrast in this area of taking of oaths, which is maybe not something that we think about a lot, but for the Jews, they did. Verse 33, again, you have heard that it was said to those of old. Remember, Jesus basically starts these six contrasts in that same way. But here's what they had heard before. You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. You shall not swear falsely. Was it okay for the Jews to take oaths? Was it okay for the Jews to swear. Now, we're not talking about foul language here. Sometimes we hear the word swear and we're thinking about four-letter words. We're talking about taking an oath, making a vow. Was it wrong? Was Jesus saying it was wrong to take oaths? Was it wrong for the Jews to take oaths? They did. They did take oaths, and they took them on a variety of occasions. What they would typically do, though, in the Jewish mind, not the Jewish law, but in the Jewish mind, they divided their oaths into two categories. The oaths where you took the oath in the name of God, and you brought down the name of God in this particular vow, and then these other promises that you made. These other vows, but you didn't say it, you know, that you were doing it in the name of God. And so if you didn't say you were doing it in the name of God, then guess what? You didn't have to keep that in the Jewish mind, not the Jewish law. I'm just talking about the Jewish mind. If you didn't say that I promise that I'm going to do this in the name of God, if you just said I promise to do this, you know, by the temple, well, okay, then no big deal, right? Because you didn't use the name of God. And so go back to your Ten Commandments in your mind. And what's the commandment? Not to take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. We often only think about that in relationship to we should not say things today where we use the name of God in an inappropriate fashion, saying, oh my God, or God this, or God that. Well, that's true. We shouldn't say any of that. But for them, it was more than that. It wasn't just you shouldn't use that name in that way, but was don't use his name in a vow, in an oath that you're not going to keep. If you bring down the name of God, then that is a vow that you have to keep. You can't use the name of the Lord your God in vain to try to convince somebody, oh, I'm really going to keep this promise now because I've used the name of God. No, you keep that vow when you've brought down the name of God. Now, there were several vows. Go over to the book of Exodus, just to see this for a second. Go over to Exodus chapter 22. I don't know if we're familiar with the fact that they did take vows, they did make oaths back then, but they were done in such a way to make sure that they're, you know, today we would say what? Our word is our bond. You ever heard that? You ever said that? That should be enough. Look in Exodus chapter 22. We'll just look at a couple passages here. One in Exodus, one over in Deuteronomy. Exodus chapter 22. Remember, where are the ten in the book of Exodus, where are the Ten Commandments found? What chapter? You got in chapter 20. So we're two chapters after the Ten Commandments are given. But don't think about it just, okay, the Ten Commandments are done, and so now this is just kind of fluff after the Ten Commandments. This isn't fluff. It wasn't just the ten that were important. It's the rest of the, and so God is giving his law in its entirety while they're there at Sinai. Look in verse 10 of chapter 22. If a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep, and it dies, is hurt, or driven away, no one seeing it, then an oath to the Lord shall be between them both. What's happened? He's delivered some animal to his neighbor, but it dies, it's hurt, something happens to that animal. Well, how do you make this right? An oath is made. But he says, it's an oath of the Lord shall be between them both, that he has not put his hand into his neighbor's good. The owner of it shall accept that, and he shall not make it good. What's the point? Here's an animal, something's happened to this animal. Well, how do I affirm to my neighbor, I didn't want something, I didn't cause this. You take an oath and you make that an oath of the Lord. Go over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. You know Deuteronomy chapter 6, it's the passage we would think of where we read in verse 4, the Lord thy God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength. And so we know that part of this. Drop down to Deuteronomy chapter 6 to verse 13. You shall fear the Lord your God and serve him. Should you do that? Well, certainly. Fear God, serve him, and shall take oaths in his name. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are all around you. So were they permitted to take oaths in the Old Testament? Yeah. They were to take oaths. And were they permitted to take oaths in the name of God? Well, certainly. They were not only permitted, they were told to take these oaths in the name of God. And verse 14, not to take them in the name of pagan gods. And so when Jesus comes along in the Sermon on the Mount and he's dealing with this, what's the point here? Well, the Pharisees in particular, the Jews had taken this to, as they often did, an extreme. And they saw these statements made by God in the Old Testament. Oh, well, you know, if we don't use the name of God in the oath, then we can break it. It's just we've got to be careful that we don't take an oath in the name of God. Well, look at what Jesus says. Come back to Matthew chapter 5. This is what's been said of old, verse 33. You shall not swear falsely, but you should perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, verse 34, do not swear at all, neither by heaven. Is it a big deal? In their mind, if I swear by heaven, that's a pretty high, lofty promise, but I haven't said God, so it's not the highest. Well, what's Jesus say? Don't swear by heaven, because guess what you're doing if you swear by heaven? It's God's throne. You can't get away from God by not using his name. Don't swear by the earth in verse 35. Well, I haven't said God. Jesus says you can't get away from God. The earth is his footstool. Don't swear by Jerusalem. Again, if we had time, we'd go over to chapter 23 where they made a difference between swearing against the temple and swearing against the gold of the temple. Oh, swear against the temple, yeah, you really shouldn't do it. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, oh, well, that's serious. What does Jesus say here? Don't swear by the earth. That's God's footstool. Don't swear by Jerusalem. And as you read through this, again, in the Jewish mind, think, well, I'm not saying God. He's saying, yes, you are. If you say Jerusalem, that's the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your own head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. Your own head does not belong to you. And so all of these things belong to God. And so you don't need to go around thinking, as long as I don't bring in the name of God into this oath, I can break it. Jesus' point is, you can't get away from God. You can't make an oath. You cannot make a promise that does not include God. Would it be wrong for us today to make an oath? Would it be wrong for us today to swear to something in a particular oath or a vow? Sometimes people struggle with, should I lay my hand on a Bible and raise my right hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Did Jesus ever get involved in an oath? Did he ever get involved in a judicial oath? Go over to chapter 26. Go to Matthew chapter 26. Jesus is on trial in Matthew chapter 26. And while he's on trial, verse 62. Matthew 26, verse 62. While Jesus is on trial, a high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? Verse 63, but Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Put your hand on the Bible and raise your hand. I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. If it is wrong for us to take an oath today, Jesus should have said, I'm not engaging in this with you. Or Jesus could have just said nothing. So I'm not going to engage in this. But what does he say in verse 64? It is as you have said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God, right hand of the power, and coming on the clouds of heaven. So are some oaths still permitted today? I think we need to be mindful of what those oaths would involve. We certainly don't need to bring in the name of God in any way where that name of God should not be found. But here's the deal. Do I have to lay my hand on a Bible and raise my other hand and affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and that be the moment where I'm telling the truth? Is that? All right, so one of our advanced students, Bonnie, she keeps reading. So look in verse 37. Verse 37, what does Jesus say? Let your yes be yes, and your no, no. What's his point? Do you have to swear, take an oath, that I'm telling the truth on this? No. Christians should be ones who tell the truth all of the time. And so if I tell the truth all of the time, do I have to swear I'm telling you the truth, cross my heart, hope to die that I'm telling you the truth? Is that what I do? Do I swear I'm telling you the truth, cross my heart, and what else we say? On my mama's grave, I'm telling you the truth. Well, I don't know if your mom told the truth or not. Do I trust your mama's grave on this? As a Christian, do I need to double down on, well, I swear I'm telling you the truth. If I say something, what's Jesus saying? It needs to be the truth. My yes, it means yes. If I give you a promise and I say yes, then I'm gonna do it. I don't have to swear I'm going to do it, nor should I be called upon 10 times to check if I'm gonna do it. Gary? We do have a bad habit of that, don't we? That we sometimes, and I don't know why that is, Gary. I think sometimes we're kind of flippant with our words and our promises. Maybe we, in a particular moment, we might say something that we think the other person wants to hear. Hey, you know what? I'll give you a call this week. And as Gary said, what do we end up doing? Not doing it. Or telling somebody we're going to come over and see them, and we don't end up doing it. Sometimes we might say something that we think the other person wants to hear, but we don't follow through with it. We, as Christians, we need to be people of our word. And what we say, the expression, our word is our bond, is a great expression. What we say needs to be something that people, when they look at us, they don't need us to put our hand on a Bible to say this is absolutely the case, or to swear on something or cross whatever and what it, that if I've said this, I mean this, and you can count on it. Helen? Well, we, as Helen says, we are to obey the laws of the land. Some have been uncomfortable with the words, I put your hand in here and do you swear? And so instead, what do they want the word to be? Do you affirm? So your hand is here and your hand is here. Honestly, that's kind of semantics. If you want my personal opinion about it, are you going to tell the truth? Are you going to affirm that you're telling the truth? We don't like the word swear, which I get it. I don't like the word swear either because it has other implications behind it. But do I need to be somebody, whether I'm in a court of law before a judge who can find me in contempt and throw me in jail if I lie, or if I'm just telling a brother or sister, I'm really sorry for what you're going through. I'll give you a call this week. Whatever the situation, do I need to be somebody of my word? Cain? Yep. You have examples of God himself taking an oath. You've got it over in Hebrews chapter 6 as well, where God took an oath and made a promise in Hebrews 6 verses 17 and 18. So you have God taking an oath. You have Jesus taking an oath. Did I put any other verses up here? The 2 Corinthians 1 and Galatians chapter 1 are both Paul affirming, taking an oath, bringing the name of God into a statement that he's making. And so they're not wrong to make, but we have to make sure that we are careful with our word and with our promises, and particularly not using God's name where God's name doesn't belong. Friend, was that your hand? Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, and we've got to be people who keep our promises. The book of Ecclesiastes talks about, when you make a vow to God, then you keep that vow to God. And so whether that vow, that promise is to God or to man, we've got a responsibility to keep it and not have to figure. And here was the Jews. They were what the reason this is a thing is the Jews were finding loopholes in whether they had to keep the vow or not. Oh, I didn't say God. I just swore on the temple. So there was a loophole for them that if they needed to get out of it, oh, I can get out of it. Phil? Absolutely. It's backing up and putting the emphasis on the heart that says, as Phil said, I don't know if everybody could hear him, that when I say something, people need to believe that I'm telling the truth, just in the same way that, you know, my heart guards me against and keeps me from committing other acts, the murder, the adultery. The focus is on the heart and making sure, again, that my righteousness is not on some superficial, outward, external level, but is focused on making sure that I'm right with God. Again, these Jews thought they could make a promise, they could make a vow that did not include God, if I just don't say his name. Hello? You can't do anything in this life. You can't make any promise that's not going to include God. Let's get down to verse 38. You get this fifth area of contrast that Jesus is going to deal with, and that's in the matter of retaliation. Again, the Jews had manipulated their laws and their traditions to make and define loopholes in a variety of places. Verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And you might read that and you might think, I'm glad I don't live under that law. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That law was not just Jewish law. That was an ancient law of mankind before the Jewish nation ever existed. God put that law into play from the beginning of time. If you read the code of Hammurabi from about the 18th century BC, you're going to read that same concept. But you might think, man, that's not nice. You know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But it was actually designed as a law of mercy. And you might think that's not very merciful. An eye for an eye is not very merciful. It was. It was designed as a law of mercy because the injury could not, the punishment could not exceed the injury. And so you couldn't say, well, this person poked my eye out. All right, so I'm going to chop their leg off. There had to be a balance. And so that's why it was put in place, is that there had to be a balance between what was done, the wrong that was done, and the punishment that was inflicted. The other part of this law is that it was not up to the individual to enforce it. This law was given to the judge. In Deuteronomy chapter 19. So it was the judge was to be the one to determine, to make sure that these things were weighed out evenly in these cases. But look at what Jesus says. Here's this law, and an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's a part of the law of God. So again, it's not that Jesus is saying we're going to scrap that entirely. It's that Jesus is trying to deal with these Pharisees who had taken that, who had manipulated it, and they were trying to find loopholes again for revenge, for retaliation, and to kind of up the ante, as it were, to see how much more they could do something to somebody. And so in verse 39, what does Jesus say? But I say to you, not to resist an evil person. What does he mean by that? If somebody does you evil, what are you supposed to do? You do evil in return? That's always beneficial, right? Somebody does you wrong, you do them wrong in return, and everybody just shakes hands and says, good game. That was fun. Did that work out? Somebody does you wrong, you do them wrong, and all right, we're even now. How is it that you never get even? You ever noticed? You know, we'll just do this and then we'll be even. And it's like, what's that? Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, wait, no, that was a little bit, you did a little bit more to me than what I did to you. So let me do something that never gets there. And that's where the Jews were. So Jesus says, and so what he's going to do here, he's going to deal with five life situations. And he says, let me give you five situations that you're going to face. And your responsibility is not to be somebody who seeks revenge or retaliation in these. So Verse 39 says, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. Anything more humiliating than being slapped? Why in the world did the Will Smith slap get so much publicity, by the way? That just was kind of weird to me. Anyway, I shouldn't have brought that up. The slap that was being talked about then was not with the palm of the hand. The most insulting slap to the Jew was with the back of the hand. Somebody slapped you with the back of their hand, it was one of the most insulting things that could be done. And so you've been insulted in that way, and what does Jesus say to do? To retaliate? Say, all right, you did it to me, I'm going to do it to you, and then we'll be even. No. Jesus says, here's a situation where you have been physically wronged, and Jesus says, what you need to do is just go ahead and take it, and not just take it, but to allow it to happen again, if such were to happen. Verse 40, if anyone wants to sue you, so now we're in some kind of a litigation matter, if anybody wants to sue you, what do? You sue the pants off of them. You hire the best lawyer you can and you slap them back. If anybody wants to sue you, and take away your tunic, New King James has the word tunic, let him have your cloak also. The tunic was an inner garment, a less expensive thing. It was usually a very long from how can we have 5 minutes left? That's not cool. All right, so the tunic was that inner garment that they wore. When you read about Peter and John chapter 1, who's out fishing, and he saw Jesus on the shore, and it says he put on his garment and he dove into the water to swim up to Jesus. It doesn't mean that Peter didn't have any clothes on. It means that he had his tunic on, this long, almost head-to-toe inner garment, but the cloak was the outside, kind of the robe, as you might think of it. That was the more valuable part, the robe, the cloak. That was something, even under Jewish law, if you gave away your cloak in a deal, in some kind of a bargain, that person couldn't keep your cloak overnight. I think it's in Exodus chapter 22. It says, if you had to give your cloak away in some kind of a deal, they couldn't keep your cloak at night. You had to get it back because your cloak was your cover. It was your pillow. You had to have it at night. But what does Jesus say? Somebody wants to sue you, what do? You take them back. He says, here's somebody who wants to do you wrong. And he says, go ahead and let them have something more than what they're after. There's a challenging passage for Christians over in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 where Paul deals with this matter of taking your brother to court and how frequent that must have been to even have to deal with this in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 7 says, now therefore it is already an utter failure for you. It's an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another. Here are Christians suing other Christians, and he says, when you're doing that, that's an utter failure. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourselves be cheated? You want a challenging verse, personally, to say, you know what? It's not about me. It's about the fact that the name of Jesus is being dragged through the mud, and I need to accept the wrong. And that's what Jesus is dealing with in verse 40 over here. Says, just go ahead and let him have your cloak also. Verse 41, whoever compels you to go with them 1 mile. Under Persian law, this is going back a ways, but under Persian law, they could compel someone into service, particularly like in the mail carrier service. They could compel somebody to carry the mail. The Babylonians brought that in as well. The Romans brought that in as well to say that a soldier could compel somebody into service. Why did Simon of Cyrene carry Jesus' cross? Remember the word that's used? He was compelled to carry Jesus. Why did he carry his cross? Because a Roman official compelled him into service. Here, buddy, get over here and do this. So what if a Roman official forced you into service? What does Jesus say? Don't just go 1 mile. Go 2 miles. Go the extra mile. Can you imagine the government forcing you to do something, and what does Jesus say? Push back against them. Say, you're violating my rights, right? That's what Jesus says to do. Go with them too. But you can have a rotten attitude while you're doing it, right? I mean, you can go that second mile where you can be doing all that, but you're going the second mile, right? I don't think so. Jesus is focused on the heart. Verse 42, give to him who asks you. Somebody comes along and under Jewish law, if somebody needed money, you gave it to him. If somebody needed a loan, a Jew, you gave it to him and you didn't even charge him interest. Jesus says, if you want to be an imitator of God, if you want to be set apart from the world, then you need to be somebody who does not seek vengeance. In many of these cases where everybody else would think this is a time to retaliate. I want you to think about how this applies to us, and we don't have time to make everything we need to. Romans chapter 12 says, do not return evil for evil, but return good for evil. Romans chapter 12 is a place that talks about that if when somebody does you wrong, that you heap those coals of fire upon their head. Obviously, that's not literal. We talk about killing somebody with kindness. Somebody does us wrong, we go out of our way to do them right in return. Did Jesus ever have anybody do anything wrong to him? Every day. Did Jesus go out of his way to do them right? Every day. Richard? Yes. Yep. And so you see again, Richard's talking about the context of the eye for an eye back in Exodus chapter 21. You see in that context as you finish reading it that there was mercy involved in the law. And that's what Christ is trying to get them back to, are these five things, are our response here, are these not responses of mercy? Not demanding my rights, not, oh yeah, I've been wronged, but being merciful. All right, we didn't get to the last one. All right, so next week, we got to finish that up and get into chapter 6. Thank you all very much for your good attention today.